It requires federal agencies to streamline grant applications, to co-manage federal programs, to eliminate heavy-handed reporting requirements. That gives tribes more autonomy to make your own decisions, not to mention it's more efficient.
Brandon Yellowbird Stevens, vice chair of the United Nation of Wisconsin, hopes the order will streamline the process.
Many tribes, it doesn't even matter if you're small or large and have the infrastructure, it becomes cumbersome managing the grants, the strings attached, the reporting, and many times tribes just don't have the capacity to seek out the grants.
Southeast Alaska is mourning the loss of a Haida elder from Craig, who died at the age of 102. The Tlingit and Haida Central Council shared the news of Fred Hamilton Sr.'s passing by saying he walked out into the forest. Hamilton was one of the raven moiety and owl, brown bear, and flicker crests. The council says the elder, who was born in 1921 and the middle of nine children, was the oldest known living Haida. Whether it was serving on school boards or city councils or as a volunteer firefighter and a timekeeper at school's basketball games. At his 100th birthday celebration, he gave this advice: be friendly, help others, and do not dwell on bad things that may happen in life. I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to an end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 7th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Alex Gonzalez and Jill Freitas. The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year campaign, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, coming up next.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News In-Depth. In August of 1945, in preparation for the Nazi war crimes trials, the victorious Allied powers, the US, the Soviet Union, Britain, and France, produced a document called the London Charter of the International Military Tribunal, which became known as the Nuremberg Charter in reference to the German city where the main trials would take place. Some commentators believe the charter has great relevance for the situation we're now witnessing in Gaza. Richard Drake is a history professor at the University of Montana who recently wrote about the importance of the Charter for Counterpunch. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
So the Nuremberg Charter, the relevance to the situation in Gaza. I mean, some people would say that Nuremberg was winner's justice and they didn't really deal with the Allied crimes, you know, the firebombing of the German and Japanese cities, the dropping of the atomic bombs. So how legitimate can such a charter be, or such an example of putting people on trial be?
I would say all of those criticisms of the Nuremberg Charter are accurate, they're legitimate, but the section of the charter that I cited in the essay that you've read, dealing with crimes against humanity, really is the moral high point of that document. And I think it serves as a model for the kind of thinking we should be employing about war crimes today, and especially with regard to what's going on in Gaza right now. So I think you're right. I mean, there are some flaws in the Nuremberg Charter. Victor's justice is a very accurate way to think of it, but there are elements in it, I think, that rise above the flaws and really have been used, I think, ever since as a kind of exemplary standard for the way we should think about war crimes.
And the section that you're referring to, crimes against humanity, would that conform pretty much to what we think of as international law on that subject?
I think it influenced international law a great deal, especially Article 6 of the Nuremberg Charter and the portion of that article dealing with crimes against humanity really shines a bright light, I think, on the whole question of war crimes and how we should think about them.
And then there are people on the pro-Palestinian side who would say the issue is simple. There is oppressor and oppressed, subjugated and subjugator, colonized and colonizer, and they, the other side, are responsible for war crimes. We are merely engaging in resistance. So how do you respond to that argument?
I think that there is a great deal to be said for that argument, but the point in the Nuremberg Charter that I think is highly relevant today, and especially with regard to Gaza, is that violence of the kind happening in Gaza today against civilians is always immoral, no matter who employs it. And if we follow that principle, the criticism of the Likud government in Israel is understandable, but also the attack on Israeli civilians on October 7th also would be ruled out by the logic and the ethical standards employed by the Nuremberg Charter. And I think that's a legitimate point, that civilians should not be targeted in the way that they are being targeted in Gaza right now by Israel, or the way they were targeted by Hamas on October 7th. Both of those actions would be proscribed by the Nuremberg Charter, Article 6, Crimes Against Humanity section.
Yeah, I think what Hamas has said is, well, we didn't set out to kill all those people. We just wanted the hostages. Do you think that has any validity? Or doesn't it matter because they killed all those people?
And if we follow the language of the Nuremberg Charter, it's a remorselessly unforgiving language that we find there. Civilians, children, women, old people, they are to be protected from the kind of violence that is coming from both, that came from both sides on October 7th, from the Palestinian side, Hamas side, and ever since then from the Israeli side. Violence against civilians is always wrong. That's the argument of the document. I think it's a principle that deserves to be honored.
It's a slightly different but related subject. What do you make of the way the Biden administration is handling this? They do seem to make statements about protecting civilians, but how serious is that if they're so supportive of Israel?
Not very serious, in my view. I think that the administration has made a tragic mistake, a tragic miscarriage of justice and ethics and mercy by going along with the terror bombing of Gaza. Just how I see that activity right now. You cannot be dropping 2,000-pound bombs on refugee centers full of small children and expect the world to applaud you and to think of you as a defender of democracy and liberty and freedom, which is what we're trying to claim we're doing. I think it's an absurd argument. I think it's going to backfire on us. And all over the world, and particularly the global South, the negative reaction to American policies in supporting Likud in Gaza is really generating a lot of blowback. It's a famous term that Chalmers Johnson used in his marvelous blowback trilogy of some years ago. It's so much of the terrorism that the United States faces in the world, Johnson argued in those books, really comes from blowback to our own policies. I think this is a very important way to think about the problem of terrorism in the world today.
Yeah, I guess some people like Noam Chomsky would even argue that the number one terrorist is the U.S. and not those other countries.
His colleague, man with whom he wrote many books over the years, Edward Herman, I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Manufacturing Consent, yeah.
Yeah, and they wrote, Manufacturing Consent is a great book. Another book that Herman wrote that really comes to mind as you raise his name was The Real Terror Network, a book he wrote in the early Reagan years, the early 1980s. The role of the United States, he was particularly interested in the CIA and the nefarious work that the CIA conducted worldwide, undermining governments, sowing the seeds of terrorism worldwide. That's a powerful book, and I think a very legitimate argument that he makes in there about a major source of terrorist activity in the world comes from our side.
Do you remember in 1965, the Suharto coup in Indonesia, and 500,000 people were killed, and that was with CIA complicity, with the Nuremberg Charter cover complicity, as well as the actual killing?
The book to be read on that subject is Vincent Bevins's The Jakarta Method. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I haven't heard of that. Okay.
Years ago, in which he analyzed that tragic event and emphasized the crucial role that the CIA played in supporting the murder of over a million people.
It was not 500,000. It was over a million.
It was, according to Bevins in his book.
Okay.
Which I recommend all your listeners to read that book. It's a powerful study about really this whole blowback idea that many of our policies have been undertaken in such a way as to generate hatred of the United States worldwide. And we really need to address those causes of terrorism, those domestic causes of terrorism, in addition to being concerned about groups like Hamas and ISIS. We have our own problem within, domestically, internally, on this question of terrorism. And the Jakarta Method really zeroes in on this issue of Indonesia and what happened there in the mid-1960s. It really was a culminating example of CIA intervention that really began in 1953 in Iran.
Was it in Greece even earlier in the 40s?
I think came later. Well, there was an earlier episode, but then in 1967 with the colonels, that was another example of America supporting right-wing reactionary governments. Mm-hmm. Any government was okay so long as it protected the corporate capitalist system.
And it was anti-communist. Yeah.
Yeah. But there was a series of episodes engineered by the CIA, Operation Ajax in Iran, 1954 in Guatemala. That was another major case of United States interference in the democratic politics of foreign countries, something we have been quite vociferous in our accusations against Putin for doing. But we've done plenty of this ourselves. And Indonesia was yet another one of those events, Iran, Guatemala, Indonesia, Greece, and other places as well. But we have a very shabby record in that department.
And I recall Indonesia as well killed off, I think, a third of the East Timorese population. Not too much publicity here about that.
No, that's been safely buried.
Yeah.
We don't look at ourselves in the mirror. That's one of the great critiques of Chalmers Johnson, the great University of California, Berkeley political scientist, in addition to the books we've already mentioned by the Blowback Trilogy, his last book, the book he wrote the year he died, I think he died in 2010 or 11, but the last book he wrote was called Dismantling the Empire, and he meant dismantling the American Empire, which is global, and it is defended by 800 military bases worldwide. And his argument was, until we come to terms with that fundamental imperialist problem of our own, we are on the same path, and he actually uses this example, this historical example, we are on the same path that ancient imperial Rome took to its decline and fall, the great study by Edward Gibbon, which Chalmers Johnson cites at great length in the second volume of the Blowback trilogy. There's a parallel, there's an historical parallel between what we are doing now in the 20th and 21st centuries and what ancient imperial Rome did 2,000 years ago. And the end will be the same. It will be the same unless we take action against the status quo. Problems of terrorism, problems of imperialism, colonialism, all of these problems are propelling us down the road of catastrophe. And I'm afraid what's happening in Gaza right now as we speak is an illustration of that tragedy.
Yeah, I often think of the U.S. as the modern Rome, but some of that is because we have a Senate, and they put a lot of stock in their Senate. I think the Senate is the only institution in the government, or according to the Constitution, that can't be abolished, although it doesn't say so explicitly. That's what it amounts to.
Sometimes they get a pretty good impression of abolishing themselves.
Yeah.
Because of their active role in furthering the business of the country.
What do they say? That's the place where the bills go to die.
Indeed.
That was University of Montana Professor Richard Drake speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KABU News In Depth. Thank you for being with us. I'm Althea Billings.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Stalemate in the Ukraine war. A political assassination plot on U.S. soil. In Israel, the ceasefire ends and an intelligence failure is revealed. Stalemate in the Ukraine war. Ukraine and Russian forces are essentially in a standoff. In a recent essay and interview with The Economist, Ukraine's top general, Valery Zaluzhny, said, quote, "Ukraine is at a stalemate with Russia, and there will most likely be no deep and beautiful breakthrough. Ukraine and Russia," he said, "have reached a stupor, fighting in trenches as in World War I, neither side able to gain on the other. The simple fact is," he said, "that we see everything the enemy is doing, and they see everything we are doing. In order for us to break the deadlock, we need something new." He said Ukraine needs a technological leap, calling for new air power, electronic warfare and counter-battery capability, and mind-breaching technology. The Ukraine counteroffensive has made some gains, but no breakthrough that might suggest victory in the near term. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin's officials have made clear that Russia has the resources to go on indefinitely. The economy has not caved in, as some predicted. A main reason is oil revenues. In 2022, Russia earned even larger annual revenues from oil than in 2021, with 2022 receipts jumping by 28%. That means Russia's budget deficit can shrink and military expenditures can rise, very dramatically, to 6% of GDP. Russia has been able to circumvent oil sanctions by finding more customers outside Europe, namely China and India. Unless the U.S. and other major oil exporters flood the market with oil to reduce its price, Russia will continue to have plenty of money to finance its war. Putin can also count on public support, or at least grudging acceptance of the war. Polling by the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center and the Levada Center show that the Russian people, far from hoping to topple Putin, support continuing the war by 68%. Only 20% oppose the war. 72% support peace talks, but not with concessions to Ukraine. Russians oppose giving up any territory seized from Ukraine. Many people are tired of the war, but, says the study, quote, "the average Russian believes it is their duty to endorse what the state deems to be moral and right, including repressive laws and support for a president in wartime." Some Western officials are now predicting the war could last another 5 years. it is already putting a serious strain on U.S. and European resources. The Germans, French, and others in the European Union have actually been expanding their weapons shipments to Ukraine, but public fatigue may come into play at any moment. The Europeans are worried about the U.S. commitment, not Biden's, but the Republican right wing's, and Trump's, if he's successful next November. If the Americans should bow out, will Europe keep on? According to the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, the Ukraine public's continued strong support of resistance to Russia and great confidence exists that Ukraine will win. Ambassador Mark Green writes that despite a 29% drop in Ukraine's GDP and over 9,600 civilian deaths, polls show that, quote, 85% of Ukrainians surveyed say they believe the country's future is rather promising, unquote. About 70% believe Ukraine will recover territory lost to Russia. Nearly 80% say they would like Ukraine to join NATO, and 94% believe Ukraine will win the war. No war fatigue there either. A political assassination plot on U.S. soil. It has happened before and nearly happened again. An important figure in opposition to a foreign government was targeted for assassination on U.S. soil, causing serious problems for U.S. relations with that government. India, in this case. The target of the murder-for-hire plot was Gurpatwant Singh Panun, general counsel for the New York-based Sikhs for Justice, a group that advocates the creation of an independent Sikh state called Khalistan within India. The assassination plot has also strained Canada-India relations, where another Sikh leader, Hadeep Singh Nijjar, was assassinated in June in a city near Vancouver, B.C. The U.S. charges that an Indian government intelligence official arranged with a man named Nikhil Gupta to carry out the assassinations. The Biden administration has sent two senior officials to New Delhi to demand an accounting. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in Canada has directly accused the Indian government of ordering the killing. Despite the abundant evidence of an Indian government plot against the overseas Sikh leadership, the U.S. and Canadian protests reportedly fall well short of a threat to disrupt relations. It's more a matter of don't do it again. Nikhil Gupta has been arrested in the Czech Republic and awaits extradition to the U.S. All the Indian government has said is that it will investigate. Sounds eerily like what happened after the Saudi leader, Mohammed bin Salman, was found to have ordered the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Lots of U.S. protests, a CIA finding of guilt, and now, see how valuable an ally Mohammed bin Salman is to the U.S. government. In Israel, the ceasefire ends and an intelligence failure is revealed. A dispute over Israel's demand for the release of all women and children hostages before the release of men caused the breakdown of the ceasefire, according to CNN and the Israeli press. The war has resumed with renewed intensity in the south of the Gaza Strip. As I speak, an Israeli ground invasion seems to be underway. Fuel and other aid deliveries have been reduced to a trickle. Once again, the Israeli Defense Forces have made clear that no area is safe for civilians if a Hamas presence is detected. That puts Palestinians who have been urged to flee to the south in an impossible predicament. What Israel may one day designate as a safe area becomes a war zone the next. Despite efforts by the Biden administration, the UN Relief Agency, and others to urge restraint on Israel, its actions seem guided by Prime Minister Netanyahu's insistence on total victory now that the ceasefire is a dead letter. Meantime, an explosive story concerning Israel's intelligence failure casts a new light on the war's origins. Turns out that over a year before the Hamas attack, Israeli intelligence secured documentation showing that it knew exactly what Hamas planned to carry out October 7. But the Israelis discounted the plan as being unrealistic and therefore not worth planning for. I assess the causes of the intelligence failure in my Substack reporting. In other news, the Chinese are running here. A new phenomenon has hit China. It's called the run philosophy. Simply put, it means that when life becomes too difficult, run to another country. And the U.S. is one of the popular destinations for the runners. Repressive rule, the post-COVID economic blues, limited employment opportunities. These are among the main reasons people have embraced the run philosophy. From the standpoint of immigration to the U.S., the Chinese influx is rather startling. About 24,000 people reached the Mexico border in the past year, more than in the last 10 years combined. Once they arrive in South America, usually visa-free Ecuador, they make their way to the U.S. the same way many others do, with smugglers through the jungles. Once in the U.S., however, the Chinese have advantages. Better than average success with immigration courts, language familiarity once in New York, and less likelihood of being deported, since China will not take them back. Deporting asylum seekers is illegal in Britain. Britain's Supreme Court has ruled that a policy to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful, dealing a major blow to a conservative government that has long described the plan as central to its pledge to stop small boat arrivals. The ruling was that deportation is unsafe and violates both British and international law. The ruling also overturns an arrangement that former Prime Minister Boris Johnson had made with Rwanda, under which Rwanda would be paid about $175 million in return for accepting the refugees. The ruling has implications for us. If elected, Donald Trump has vowed to deport asylum seekers here as part of a wide-ranging assault on immigrants and human rights. North Korea is spending more on the military, less on diplomacy. When it comes to budgeting, North Korea follows a familiar pattern. Weapons always have priority over everything else. Shortly after North Korea, on its third try, launched a military spy satellite into orbit, South Korea responded by removing a no-fly zone near its border with the North, and then announcing it would launch its own spy satellite. North Korea announced it too would stop honoring the no-fly zone. Both sides also withdrew an agreement not to engage in live fire drills in that zone, all of which mean that both Koreas will be spying on each other even more intensely than before, thus increasing the chance of a disastrous miscalculation of the other's intentions. Cutting its diplomatic presence abroad evidently is one way to save money. As North Korea tightens relations with China and Russia, it is also closing embassies in several countries, starting with Spain, Uganda, Angola, and Hong Kong, altogether about a quarter of the total. One reason for the closures may be purely economic. Running embassies is costly, and the returns on investment can be meager. That seems to be the case with the North Korean embassy in Spain, for instance. Sanctions against North Korea, including pressure from the United States, may also be responsible, reducing North Korea's ability to earn foreign exchange, as it had done in Africa. Nevertheless, North Korea still has diplomatic relations with 160 countries, or about 80% of the UN's membership. So talking about North Korea as the hermit kingdom doesn't square with its international presence. Modernizing the U.S. nuclear force. On the highly questionable argument that the plutonium in atomic weapons is deteriorating, the Pentagon is planning on refurbishing them by building a large number of plutonium pits. First, the land-based ICBMs and then the submarine-launched missiles will be refitted, all as part of an estimated total nuclear weapon modernization cost of about $1.5 trillion. Mind you, there is shaky evidence of plutonium disintegration and better evidence that the current nuclear warheads can work just fine for perhaps another 40 years. But there's no stopping the military-industrial complex. Taiwan's presidential election. On January 13, Taiwan voters will choose their next president. Lai Jingda of the Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, is currently the vice president under President Tsai Ing-wen. The DPP officially accepts the principle of one China, but acts in keeping with the idea of Taiwanese autonomy and tight relations with the United States. That makes the DPP and Lai targets of Beijing's wrath and constant harassment of Taiwan by jet fighters. The other two candidates have friendlier views of China. Go Wen-ru of the Kuomintang is the front-runner. He's a former mayor of Taipei and seeks to restore business and other ties with China. Beijing has always preferred a Kuomintang candidate. The third candidate, Ho Youri, is from the new Taiwan People's Party, which has no clear view on relations with China and is far behind in the polls. Ho and Go had been expected to unite against Lai of the DPP in the election, but that has not happened. Beijing's main response is twofold, warning against the election of the DPP slate, saying it represents a move toward Taiwan independence and therefore war, and offering cut-rate trips to the mainland for Taiwan politicians, mainly local-level people. Hundreds of them have reportedly accepted the trips, which violate Taiwan election laws. An investigation is underway. Finally, an update on COP28, the International Climate Change Conference. Two items that tell us where the real problem lies. A whistleblower has delivered a 50-page document from the United Arab Emirates that confirms fears that COP28, which began November 30th, would be just another effort by the fossil fuel industry to sideline alternative energy activists. As I reported last week, the conference head, Sultan Al Jaber, is an oil executive with the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, called ADNOC, the state-run oil and gas company. The leaked document indicates that the United Arab Emirates climate officials will use the conference to push for ADNOC to complete deals on petrochemicals and liquefied natural gas. "I can't believe it," said Antonio Guterres at the UN when he heard of the document. Nor was he happy about Al Jaber's comment at the conference that, quote, "there is no science out there that says the phase-out of fossil fuels is what's going to."
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
My name is Mike. I work at KBOO as the data coordinator. I'm a KBOO host. I do a little show called Pandemonium, and I am a KBOO listener. I love listening to KBOO because it doesn't sound like anything else. I wish I could take credit for that. I'd love to say the reason KBOO sounds so interesting and different is because we have the best DJs, the best reporters, the best volunteers. I believe we do. I think we have an amazing community, but I don't think that's why KBOO sounds the way that it does. KBOO sounds different because of the way we are funded. KBOO is funded by you, the listener. Everyone gets the same radio, and you contribute what you can when you decide to, and there's no advertiser interfering in the relationship between you and the programmers. They say that's not supposed to work. They've been telling KBOO that will never work for 55 years now, and you, the listener, keep proving them wrong. So please help make sure KBOO continues sounding different by keeping KBOO listener-sponsored, independent, and non-